Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States puts more people in prison than any other country, by a long shot. Now, after almost four decades of super strict drug laws, mandatory sentences, and mass incarceration, people are rethinking. Is this really the best way? Is it fair? Is it just? Is it effective? Can we afford it? This hour, On Point, rethinking the American way of crime and punishment of imprisonment. You can join the conversation. Do we get lost in a rage of imprisonment? Has it worked? Been just? Are there smarter, cheaper, better ways to deal with crime? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first today from Colchester, Vermont, is Brian Mann, reporter with North Country Public Radio and lead producer of the Prison Time Media Project, a year-long series examining the drug laws in America. Brian, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
You are up in an area of New York State doing a lot of reporting, an area that's often called the Siberia of New York. Why? Because it's been a kind of gulag, a kind of center of imprisonment?
It's one of our major industries. You know, in the 40 years that the Rockefeller-style laws have been in place, more than a dozen state and federal prisons have been built. Towns that were factory communities, farming towns, have been converted into a prison-based economy. And really, this is a trend that we've seen right across rural America. As mass incarceration has grown, so too has this infrastructure, this enormous build-out of prisons and also the jobs that go with them. 500,000 Americans work as corrections officers now, and many of them are in our backyard in the North Country of New York.
The U.S. now has nearly 2.2 million people in prison, by far the highest in the world. I mean, China, with many times our population, only has 1.5 million, and it drops very rapidly after that. Our rate of imprisonment, three times the nearest. I mean, countries that you think of as very tough and unappealing in this way, 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 way behind us. What was the inflection point that made that happen? What was it? What was the rate of imprisonment? What did our population, prison population, look like before we got tough on drugs and all the rest?
Yeah, so if you go back to the early 70s, there were about 330,000 people in prison and jails across the country. A tiny part of sort of the way our society worked was putting people behind bars. And as these tough-on-crime laws began to kick in, as they took root across the country, we saw that population grow sevenfold. And it was a reaction to a couple of things. I mean, in the late 60s and early 70s, there were riots in American cities. There was a sense of urban decay. We had a terrible heroin epidemic that was hitting many urban communities. And there was this sense, this idea that we could start a war on crime, a war on drugs that might be winnable. Maybe we could just scare criminals, scare drug addicts with these tough sentencing rules and say it's time to get clean. And that's certainly what Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York at the time, believed. He said, we're going to win this. We're going to put enough people behind bars that we'll send a message. We're going to fix it permanently. But, you know, it's played out very differently. Huge levels of incarceration. And many of those social problems they were trying to fix once and for all are still with us four decades later.
Let's hear the voice of then New York State Republican governor. This was Nelson Rockefeller, and you've been letting the country hear about this and think about this again in your excellent report, Brian. But here he was launching his campaign for what came to be known as the Rockefeller drug laws. He wanted tough prison sentences, even for low-level drug dealers and addicts. It was an idea that quickly spread, influenced state and federal laws all over the place. Here he is in 1973, Nelson Rockefeller defending his proposals.
How about society? How about the victims? How about protecting our people? And if we say we got to keep the calendar clear by putting the criminals out on the street, that's an admission of defeat of our society. I can't admit that. And as I think the legislators begin to see this thing in its full ramifications, I think they're going to take a somewhat different point of view. I have one goal, one objective, and that is to stop the pushing of drugs.
Nelson Rockefeller in 1973, man oh man, was his view infectious all over the place, but it didn't take long for people, even in his circle, and you quote them, Brian, here, Joseph Persico, one of the aides who helped push those laws through, told you that new scrutiny for all this is long overdue, that very early on, people saw the prisons he saw from the inside, prisons filling up and without being very effective. Here's Persico.
I concluded very early that this was a failure. I mean, it's filling up the prisons, first-time offenders. This was obviously unjust, not just unjust, but unwise. It was ineffective.
Unjust, unwise, ineffective, and yet we sent millions there and have spent billions. Here from a documentary called The House I Live In, this is Oklahoma Prison Security Chief Michael Carpenter talking with the filmmaker Eugene Jarecki about the American prison system and maybe what drives it.
I think sometimes we have people doing a whole lot of time for not very much crime. It's almost like they're paying for our fear instead of paying for their crime.
They're paying for our fear instead of paying for their crime. The prison population topped out at what, Brian, 2.3 million or something a couple of years back? Is the attitude, is policy really changing now?
There are changes, and I think it's being driven. You know, we talk about the justice of these laws, but what really seems to be the driver is the cost. We hit the Great Recession, and state budgets began to crash, and there were also some legal rulings in California that forced them to begin trying to cut back on their inmate populations. But it is important to say that in terms of there being a reform movement or a rethinking of mass incarceration, we are just barely at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. And essentially, there's sort of a plateau now. Some states, like New York and California, seeing measurable, significant declines in the number of people behind bars. But in many states and in the federal system, the number of inmates continues to grow. We have more inmates now than we had last year in states like Mississippi. The federal prison system continues to grow. Half the people behind bars in the federal system are drug offenders, nonviolent drug offenders. And the other thing, you know, you heard Persico talking there about the justice of this. The other thing that continues to resonate right now is that we continue to lock up a wildly disproportionate number of Black and Hispanic men. According to the latest Department of Justice statistics, nearly 8% of all Black men between the ages of 25 and 39 were in prison. That's and when you think of that constant churn of Black men going into prison, cycling through incarceration, it's become a huge part of the American experience, particularly in minority neighborhoods, in urban neighborhoods.
What do you think Nelson Rockefeller would say about that? They did the crime, so they have to do the time, or prosecution has been biased toward people of color and harder and heavier on them?
I have had fascinating conversations. Of course, Rockefeller has passed on. He wasn't available to be interviewed. But a lot of the people who were big supporters of these laws right up front, people were arm locked with Nelson Rockefeller, including people in the Black and Hispanic communities who supported these laws initially. They did not see up front what the ramifications would be. They did not know that the arrest rates in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods would be wildly disproportionate. And I heard a lot of regret, a lot of soul searching, people saying, you know, we saw our courtrooms filling up with these young Black men, and we didn't really know what to do about it. The laws were then in place. They were hugely popular. These had bipartisan support. Voters loved these tough-on-crime laws. They were a big part of the, you know, presidential campaign of Bill Clinton. Was all about tough on crime. You know, governors in across the country, Democrat and Republican, won election based on the idea of locking up a lot of people. But the prosecutors and the defense attorneys saw in the courtrooms that there was this other thing happening that has really changed that conversation.
Brian Mann, stand by there with North Country Public Radio. Great report. You're in the middle of the Prison Time Media Project. I want to go to New Orleans right now and Jarvis DeBerry, editorial writer, columnist for NOLA.com, the Times Pick and the Times Picayune there. He's frequently reported on, commented, written on Louisiana's prison system. Louisiana imprisons more of its people per capita than any other state in the country. Jarvis DeBerry in New Orleans, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we are reading reports of Bobby Jindal leading this effort to reform the juvenile justice system, early release for repeat drug offenders, and with an eye toward reducing incarceration numbers. Do you see that happening? Do you think it's coming?
That's a very good question. We have had proposals such as this before that have met with fierce opposition from the Louisiana Sheriff's Association. Just a couple of years ago, Representative Joe LaPinto, who is involved with these reform efforts, had a modest proposal to reduce the amount of time that prisoners, nonviolent prisoners, would have to serve from 46% to 40% of their sentences. And that was estimated to save the state, it would save the state about $250 million over 10 years, $253 million to be exact. And that was killed by the Louisiana Sheriff's Association.
I mean, I'm reading here your colleague at the Times-Picayune, Cindy Chang, saying, writing, the hidden engine behind Louisiana's well-oiled prison machine is cold, hard cash. Most these are for-profit facilities. Most prison entrepreneurs are rural sheriffs who hold tremendous sway. If the inmate count dips, sheriffs bleed money. No wonder they're against cutting down the numbers.
Of course, of course. And one of the most depressing statistics that Cindy Chang's reporting revealed was the state pays sheriffs $24.39 per inmate per day to house state prisoners. Some of those sheriffs have cut their food costs down to $1.43 per day, and they're not spending any money toward rehabilitating these prisoners. So you can see that if you're clearing about $18 or $20 per day per inmate, then you don't have any incentive to let these people out.
It's all about the money, Cindy,
to keep them locked up.
Cindy writes, the sheriffs trade them like horses to keep their particular facilities full as they can.
It was so reminiscent of the chattel slavery system. You know, you would have some people who were good at painting or others who were good at carpentry. And she talked about sheriffs who would just trade prisoners. I like that guy that you have that can do this. Can you send him over here? Sometimes taking them away from those scarce rehabilitation programs that do exist. It is an outrage. I shouldn't say was, to make it in the past tense, because it's still going on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America state by state reconsidering its giant prison population and what built it, what put it there. Brian Mann is with us from North Country Public Radio, broadcast all over upstate New York, with us today from Vermont. He's lead producer of the Prison Time Media Project, a year-long effort looking at American imprisonment. It is really good. Jarvis DeBerry is with us for another couple minutes here from New Orleans, writes for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Jarvis, look at the race angle here for just a minute, the racial face of this. I mean, overall, Louisiana's incarceration rate highest in the country, 5 times Iran's, 13 times China's, and very black.
Yes, yes, and that's, you know, another thing that makes this so reminiscent of, you know, Jim Crow and slavery. You know, I was slow to come around to that point. I was really converted by Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which you may have read.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mass incarceration in the age of color blindness. And she talks about how this mass incarceration is effectively operating the same way that the Jim Crow system is, meaning that if a man has gone to prison for a drug offense, say, and is released, that his social movements or his mobility is restricted at about the same way that one would have been if he had grown up in Mississippi in the 1930s or 40s. And so that, to me, shows the kind of shortcomings of the proposed legislation. It's not just enough to let people out of jail earlier than they would have been released from jail, because once they get out, what opportunities are they going to have? Will they be able to find employment, or will the fact they've been labeled felons keep them from meaningful employment for the rest of their lives? So I think we need to start trying to figure out, how do we stop people from getting into this system ahead of time, and maybe even seriously considering just putting an end to this drug war altogether, because I don't think it's a winnable war, and the costs have just been too great. It's just a human tragedy.
Jarvis, Tom, yeah, if I may, Jarvis, I know I've got to let you go there at the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com in New Orleans, but very grateful to you for being with us for a minute today. Jarvis DeBerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Brian, sorry. No, that's all right. The one thing that I want to sort of echo that Jarvis was saying, you know, there is this racial dimension to incarceration. But the other thing that's complicated the sort of moral landscape here is that so many of the inmates are African-American and Hispanic, but the vast majority of these new prisons built over the last 40 years have been built in white rural communities. And so what you have now is this painful economic advantage in rural America, where there are unions and correctional officers institutions and sheriff's associations all lobbying for mass incarceration. And I think many of these people do sincerely believe that this helps stop crime, helps limit drug abuse and use. But there is also this enormous economic incentive that breaks along racial lines. And I think in New York, in California, in other parts of the country, that's been a really hard part of the conversation to have.
And it's a political interest as well, right? These inmates get counted by the census. They bring political throw weight to these rural districts.
They absolutely do. They're counted in the prisons where they live. So if you look at northern New York, where I live, you walk down the street, everybody's white. But if you look at the census tally, we have a significant minority population. Well, they're all behind bars. And those congressional district lines, they're built around where the inmates are housed, not where they're from. New York State got tangled up in a huge lawsuit. There was a lot of pushback after the last census. So this has become one of the most controversial parts of this, how you actually give inmates their political representation.
And it builds in a kind of conflict of interest here, economic factors, political factors, and then is it effective? Is it just, here's a little bit again from The House I Live In, the documentary. This is 28-year-old Maurice Haltwanger, sentenced for possession of 50 grams of crack cocaine. The judge, Mark Bennett, wanted to give him a shorter sentence, but he could not because of mandatory minimum sentencing. Here he is explaining, the soon-to-be prisoner explaining his situation.
The minimum on a conspiracy is 10 years. And then with me having a prior drug felony, the minimum is 20 years. So I got a 20-year sentence today.
And off he goes. Multiply that into the millions, and you've got the American situation. It is hard to sustain. Current New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo, working to repeal some of those Rockefeller drug laws in his state, passed 40 years ago this year. In his 2011 State of the State speech, he spoke out against the use of prisons as a way to save local economies.
An incarceration program is not an employment program. If people need jobs, let's get people jobs. Don't put other people in prison to give some people jobs. Don't put other people in juvenile justice facilities to give some people jobs.
He's not the only governor thinking about that these days, as tough economic times have pressed budgets all over this country. Brian Mann with North Country Public Radio, please stand by. I want to bring in a couple of other voices. From Washington, Mark Maurer is with us. He's executive director of the Sentencing Project. They've worked to reform sentencing policy around the country. Mark Maurer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And with us from Austin, Texas, is Mark Levin, policy director for Right on Crime. It's a conservative criminal justice think tank. He's director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Mark Levin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Maurer, first to you. Do you see a new ripple of reconsideration of the policies that have built this huge prison population, or is it kind of self-perpetuated because so many people have an interest in it and many believe it may have an important role in deterring crime?
Well, there's still plenty of forces, institutionalized financial incentives and others, political incentives to keep a world record prison system. But I think over the last decade, we are beginning to see a shift in that political climate. I think we're seeing now that there is growing bipartisan interest in what we might think of as evidence-based corrections. Basically, you know, what are we doing in the criminal justice system to help promote public safety? Some people feel good in their gut when they lock people up in prison, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're having an impact on crime. So I think it starts with that. And then, of course, the fiscal crisis of the last several years has really focused the attention of governors across the country in considering how they want to spend their budgets. And essentially, it's become clear to them that you can continue to build prisons or you can build college classrooms, but you certainly can't do both of those. So you have to make some choices right now.
Mark Levin in Austin, Texas, you come at this from a conservative posture, and yet we've got a real problem here to affording this and looking at its effectiveness. Is your group looking at the prison population and rethinking the policies that have built it up so big, Mark?
Exactly, yes. Well, we started right on crime in 2010, kind of to build on what we had accomplished working with policymakers here in Texas, which is in the last 5 years, Texas has seen a 25% reduction in crime. At the same time, we've seen a 10% drop in our incarceration rate. And, of course, Texas is known for locking them up and throwing away the keys,
yeah.
But we've really shifted. We changed our budgetary approach back in 2007 to say instead of building more prisons, we're going to put the money in alternative programs, whether they're drug courts or stronger probation, treatment, a whole range of alternatives, and we've seen the benefits from that in lower crime and lower cost to taxpayers. So we have we launched Right on Crime with signatories to our statement of principles like Jeb Bush, Newt Gingrich, Ed Meese, the former drug czar, Bill Bennett. So
yeah.
I think it reflects the fact that within the conservative movement, we're saying we need to emphasize personal responsibility and limited government, but just growing the prison population, particularly with nonviolent offenders, isn't the way to do that.
Do you feel that message resonating with conservatives around the country, or do you run into, come off it, Mark, you know, put them in jail, that's the way to deal with this?
Well, I think we've seen tremendous progress. I mean, I'll give you an example. We had Governor Kasich call me up a few months before he became governor in
Ohio.
Printed out all your reports. Come help us in Ohio, you know, should I be elected? And we did. We put out a paper with our counterpart, a conservative think tank up in Ohio. And ultimately, Governor Kasich helped bring along the last few senators that were needed, got comprehensive legislation to reduce the low-level drug penalties, strengthen probation system, and also, I will add, allow ex-offenders to enter occupations, to get occupational licenses. And in fact, Governor Kasich spoke at a black church several months ago and said it was the most emotional thing he's done as governor. So that's one of the examples. And we're also seeing in Georgia, Governor Deal, a former prosecutor, spearheading major reforms on both the adult and juvenile side. So I think certainly there's much more work to be done, but we're seeing some very good signs.
Mark Maurer, what's the formula? If this country wants to move away from its number one status in imprisonment and yet doesn't want to have crime all over the place, wants people to feel secure in their communities, what's the formula for alternative approaches here that might make a significant reduction possible, one that would bring us somewhere near the next highest level of imprisonment in the world? What would it take, Mark Maurer?
Sure. Well, you know, a prison population is a function of two factors, you know, how many people we send to prison and how long we keep them there. And I think we've really failed on both counts. We've been far too excessive in recent decades. So in terms of who we send to prison, there's now growing interest, growing program development in trying to divert people from incarceration who don't need to be there and could benefit more effectively from other approaches.
Like
so, for
what?
Example, we've seen a very dramatic expansion of drug courts around the country in the last 20 years, essentially courts that are trying to divert people to treatment as the first option rather than incarceration for people for whom the underlying problem is really a drug addiction that's driving the crimes that they're committing. So we're sort of looking at better ways to invest money by doing that. The second part of it is just a question of how long people should be in prison. And there, we also lead the world, too. Of the people in prison today, one of every 11 is serving a life sentence, and many of them life without parole. Now, many of these people committed serious crimes, but to incarcerate them at the age of 50, 60, 70 at enormous cost really raises questions about how we're investing public safety dollars. And I think we need to rethink those excessive sentences as well. We can maintain and improve public safety without spending enormous sums on the back end.
I want to bring our listeners in, if I may. Barbara in Burlington, Vermont. Barbara, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Previous speaker touched on one thing I was going to say. I was under the impression that many prisons were privatized.
Quite right.
That's true. Someone's
yes.
making money off of them being in there, so it's, again, follow the money.
Yeah.
Money's the incentive. So, therefore, that's in the equation of the number. And the other thing, I don't think you can actually bring in Iran, China, India, and those people in the... for the figures, because their cultures are old. They have not. We're a young country. We've been bringing in immigration. We have a totally different problem.
What? So that means it's no problem here? We can just lock up more than anybody else?
Absolutely. It is a problem.
And we're not 5 years old, you know. We're 200 and counting, right? I mean, we weren't born yesterday anymore. But I take your point, though, Barbara. I take your point, and I want to go to the privatized part in particular. Brian, do you know nationally what portion of those 2.2 million in prison are in privately owned or run prisons?
Yeah, we're up around 8%. And one of the things that's interesting is that even as we have begun to shave the number of inmates who are in prison, the private prison system has continued to grow. And these private prison corporations are, you know, they've become a major part of our economy. Just yesterday, a university in Florida, in Boca Raton, announced that they were naming their college football stadium after one of these corporations. So, you know, private... After a prison corporation. It's
like
going to be
the lock them up and throw away the key stadium.
Great. Yeah, and so these are this business is again a part of the American landscape. It's sort of the new normal still, and it is continuing to grow. I want to also say, Tom, about this question of where we go next and how we sort of roll some of this back. One of the things that makes this so complicated is that for 40 years, we've used prisons to solve a lot or to try to solve a lot of really complicated social problems, mental illness, poverty, drug addiction, illegal immigration. We've used prisons as the go-to remedy, a lot of people in detention now for that. And so the solutions, trying to find alternatives, will also be really complicated. For each of those kinds of groups that we've put behind bars for long periods of time, we have to figure out, okay, what can we do with someone who's behind bars because they're mentally ill? That's a different solution than somebody who's drug addicted.
We simplified it by just locking people up, but that turns into one giant mess as well. David in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is David. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm with the Tennessee Consultation on Criminal Justice, and I have before me some recommendations which grow out of, this will go to the decision makers in Tennessee.
Okay.
It is based in large part on the state of recidivism, the revolving door of America's prisons from the Pew study on April 2011. Our focus is on reducing recidivism. And we can save millions of dollars by reducing recidivism on states which, based on states which are already effective. Some of those include Texas, which has already been noted, Oklahoma, Wyoming, and Oregon being the premier state.
Would it help bring down, I guess it obviously would, David, your prison population in Tennessee, if you could pull it off?
It will bring down prison populations. It's based on the best practices which come out of, we are using Oregon as our first model, but other states have been extraordinarily effective.
Do you think Tennesseans are ready to make a change on this front, ready to consider lock them up, to reconsider?
Well, our mantra is be smart on crime versus be tough on crime. And what sells in conservative areas is saving money.
Yeah.
Let me use some examples. And this is from the Pew study. If California reduced its populations, the 10 states that are mentioned here, by 10%, they would save $470 million in a single year. California would save $233 million per year. And interestingly enough, Jerry Brown is fighting the federal courts on this with the master that would oversee it. That master and Judge Higgins saved Tennessee, which went reluctantly into that change and has a much better managed system.
Yeah.
We use North Carolina as a corollary state, which would be close in some fashion to us. North Carolina would save $23 million.
David, it sounds like you're on the path to do this. You've got the numbers. You've got the case made. Mark Levin's listening in Austin, Texas, and I think that let's save some money message will appeal to him. We'll ask him about it after a break. David, I appreciate your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about this country, state by state, reconsidering its giant prison population and what built it, the policies that made it so incredibly large, number one in the world by a country mile. Brian Mann is with us this hour from North Country Public Radio in upstate New York. He's done some great reporting on this, a year-long effort they've got going on there called Prison Time, the Prison Time Media Project. Mark Maurer is with us from the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. Mark Levin is with us, Policy Director at Right on Crime, out of Austin there, watching Texas and the country. I want to go to Jeffrey, calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. And hi to the guests. And thanks for the show. Yeah. And you've touched a lot of things here. But I'm not really surprised that the prison population in America is so large. We were the first country back in the 1800s to have penitentiaries, the whole concept of having large areas where people would be put as a way to solve crime. And there was a philosophy at that point about what it was supposed to do. But as of now, and I've worked in the Manhattan House of Detention for Men, the Tombs, as a psychiatric aide.
Okay.
And I've worked as the head of an agency in San Francisco, also involved with the prison system there,
yep, yeah,
on behalf of my clients. And the concept now, according to the people I talked with in the amongst the guards and the enforcers, was that they want to make prisons a way that when people go in, they will be so crushed by what they encounter there that they will never even think of doing a crime again. Besides that, there is no real philosophy about what prisons are supposed to do. Are they supposed to rehabilitate people? And though you've talked about the cost, about the profit motive in driving a lot of this,
yeah,
it doesn't even do what it's supposed to do. It doesn't bring down the crime rate. Certainly, by if you take everybody who would possibly make a crime, do a crime, and put them in prison, well, maybe you won't have crime.
You know, how does crushing people square with the recidivism rate, which is by no means low? I mean, even it sounds inhumane, but it also seems not to work.
Well, we were fortunate enough to have people making studies of prisons in the 1800s, and Peter Kropotkin noted in Russia, the recidivism rate was 60%. The recidivism rate when I was there, working there, was 60%.
Jeffrey, we got it, and I appreciate your call very much. I mean, Mark Levin in Austin, if we got this right, how much less could we spend on prisons? How much lower could our recidivism rate be? How much lower could our crime rate be if we got the dials on this dashboard right?
Well, I think that's substantially, it's hard to figure out the exact, and of course there's other pieces, law enforcement and things like that, where you can actually prevent crime. But I think what one of the previous caller from Tennessee was talking about is reducing recidivism. And if you look at it, half the people coming into prison were on probation or parole. And half of those people were revoked for what are called technical violations, missing appointments, not a new offense. And so one of the exciting models for dealing with that is the Hawaii Hope Court, which has reduced reoffending and substance abuse by two-thirds. And basically, they come in for a random drug test. They call a number to find out if their color is up. And if they fail that test, they may go to jail for the weekend. But it's swift and sure and commensurate sanctions. And then also positive incentives work. We're looking at probation departments that give people bus tokens and may shorten their probation term if they're exemplary in their compliance, paying all restitution.
Yeah.
By the way, prisoners pay no restitution. This whole people on probation pay 100 times more restitution to victims. So we also need to focus on what's best for victims, particularly when we're talking about low-level property offense.
I mean, you're talking about Texas having a 25% reduction in crime and a 10% reduction in the number of inmates. What's your sense, Mark Levin, of how far down that could come if everything worked right?
Well, I think there's a lot more ways to go. I mean, Texas still obviously has one of the higher incarceration rates.
Yeah.
And I think the key is we talked about the fiscal incentive. We can reverse those fiscal incentives through a performance-based model, and that is to say to counties, if you reduce the number of people coming in, low-level offenders in particular, that you're sending to the prison system, we'll give you a share of those savings, half of it, that you can use for local public safety and community corrections programs. And so some states like Arizona implemented this model in the first year afterwards, they had almost a 40% decline in new crimes among probationers and probation revocations.
But can you incent a privately run prison to make more money on fewer prisoners? That's just not how it goes, is it, Mark?
Well, if you look in England, what they've done is they've said this is largely with nonprofits, but a nonprofit that runs a reentry program, 100% of the money they get is based on reducing recidivism. So if the people coming out of prison they're helping don't, if they are able to reduce that recidivism rate lower than the baseline, then they get money. It's a $100 million performance base, and the Conservative Party in England has put that in place, that portfolio.
And, of course, they've got to have work to do when they get out of prison. Marcy in North Augusta, South Carolina. Marcy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was a nurse manager for two South Carolina prisons, correctional facilities for 13 years, and have since, of course, continued to have an interest in it. And I had a friend, and I looked up on Google about New Jersey and having records expunged. He had had a felony, and yesterday I was going to an appointment, and there was a middle-aged black man walking, and I asked him if he would like a ride, and he got in my vehicle with me. And as it turned out, he was a James Brown backup singer in the past, and he had been released from New Jersey's prison for a felony, and he was unaware that you could have your record expunged.
Which helps with employment, which helps a lot with employment. Is it difficult?
$45 and fill out an application.
That's good practical advice, Marcy, and I appreciate it. I mean, Mark Maurer, you know, it's not as simple as what goes on behind bars or even in a courtroom. This reaches out into what opportunities people have, does it not?
Well, it certainly does. And, you know, we like to think that, you know, you're punished for your crime, you go to prison or probation, that's it. But in many ways, you continue to pay that debt often for the rest of your life. You know, around the country, there are literally thousands of prohibitions on employment and access to services and the like that apply to anyone with a felony conviction. And, you know, some of these restrictions are understandable. You know, you probably don't want a person convicted as a pedophile to work in a daycare center. But many of these restrictions, particularly on employment, don't bear any direct relationship to the crime that the person was convicted of. And in many cases, there's no time limit. So you may have been convicted of writing a bad check 20 years ago, and yet that's going to prohibit you from all sorts of employment prospects in the future.
Let's go to Jim in New Orleans. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I understand you're talking about prisons. The first thing I want to do is talk to you about the guy who was speaking about recidivism.
Yes.
The kind of dollars he was talking about is pocket change. Okay, but the message I wanted to convey was that we are looking at how to solve a problem too low in the weeds. The reason that we have the problems that we do, or that we have always had an uneven economy, which discriminated against certain elements of the population.
Yeah.
And we are operating, all of us, under one fatal assumption, that is, that we cannot turn back the clock on globalization. My argument would be that if we could put all of our people back to work in manufacturing, then we wouldn't have the budget crises that are causing a lot of our problems.
Jim, you got a big idea on the table there, but I'm glad you say, you know, don't get too far down in the weeds here. We'll pull our heads up right now on that front. I mean, Brian, let me take it to you first this way. We'll look at the economy and jobs, but you describe it in your reporting on this very effective moment where Governor Rockefeller, 40 years ago, has been seeing all these drug crime reports coming in, one after another, and there's a certain point at which he just breaks and says, enough. If I recall your reporting correctly, Brian, he says, we got to start throwing these people in jail, and I don't want to hear about the niceties. Just let's just do it. The whole country seemed to resonate to that emotional response, and I wonder if that emotional linkage is still there. Is it still powerful, or is it changing enough to let us think more broadly, think bigger, and rethink our prison policy?
Yeah, I mean, clearly this has changed. You go back and look at surveys from the 70s and the 80s, for example, when the crack epidemic was happening. Crime and drugs were way up there at the top of people's concerns. And that has shifted enormously due to the drop in crime rates in many parts of the country. And I do think it's important, Tom, to keep on the table that this effort was in response to real problems. I mean, the heroin epidemic,
sure,
the crack epidemic.
And the violence
real,
that came with it.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing, though, and this is the thing that we're wrestling with now, is that while all kinds of elements of our criminal justice system have evolved over these 40 years, we have better community policing, we have better strategies for reducing crime in many of these neighborhoods, the incarceration system was sort of frozen in place. It remained this very blunt instrument with mandatory minimums, with, you know, rules that affected people whether they had 2 ounces or a bag. I mean, it was really clumsy. And so what we're hearing now is a push for a more experimental, a more subtle approach that tries to match the crime to the punishment, that tries to, you know, make sure that people are rehabilitated to some point, so that when they are released, they don't cycle right back into the system. So in many ways, it feels like, as we're reporting on this, that we're seeing a huge prison system that's kind of struggling to catch up to the rest of the way that we handle crime and punishment in America.
Mark Maurer, what about political resistance to change on this front? The leverage of private companies who are running prisons, the leverage of rural districts with jobs on the line, your livelihoods on the line, prison guards and all the rest. How significant is that in affecting, you know, the rate of this country's reconsideration of a very expensive, big problem?
Well, it certainly is a factor. You know, if you take New York State as an example, the state has reduced its prison population by some 25% over the past decade, and yet there was a real lag in being able to close prisons in upstate New York precisely because there was a lot of local pressure to keep their jobs. So clearly, if we are going to move in this direction, we do need to pay attention to the economic needs of those hard-hit communities. You know, they lost their manufacturing jobs long ago. They came to see, I think, incorrectly, as prisons as the savior for their employment possibilities. But we need to look at those and find some more productive employment. I think on the political front, I think we are turning a corner there. You know, if you think of recent major campaigns, presidential elections, there's been hardly any public discussion about public safety issues, crime issues. In part, that's because crime rates have been going down. In part, it's because people are very focused on unemployment issues and war issues and the like. And so it does give us a moment of opportunity right now to make some real advances.
Let's go to John in Billerica, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I greatly appreciate your show. Listen every day.
Thanks.
Listen, I wanted to get a little more granular on this because I think as a doctor here, there's a flip side to this argument.
Okay.
And it's not just about dollars and cents. Growing up in Michigan, I had two friends who unfortunately got involved in drugs, one of which began working in a meth lab in the basement of a house, and another friend of mine from school got involved in using drugs, got addicted to crystal meth. He eventually committed suicide and hung himself. And my feeling on it is that, you know, there's an argument to be made for the dollars and cents side, but we do need to keep in mind that there is a lot of death and destruction dealt out by this epidemic. And is 12 years in jail an adequate sentence for that? I don't actually know. I do feel that there needs to be some stiff sort of penalty to really make people think twice about being involved in.
Yeah, John, I appreciate that perspective. And your call, Mark Levin, how about it? Where does the stick of the threat and fact of punishment and long punishment come in? You can hear our caller right there, John. He doesn't want more friends getting into meth. He wants deterrent. Is that still a strong dynamic, or are you saying there's a better way, Mark? How do you do it?
Well, I mean, drugs are a scourge. I mean, half of all high school students in this country have tried drugs, so obviously we can't rely on incarceration to solely address the problem. I think that what we know now is, of course, a lot of treatment. There are a lot of treatment programs that work. Even some pharmaceutical treatments for drug substance abuse have shown promising results, particularly for heroin. So they're definitely, and then as I said before, we've got drug courts. We've got the Hawaii Hope Court, which is geared towards more recreational users that both have very strong records of reducing recidivism and reducing substance abuse. So I think there's other ways we can address it. Obviously, for drug kingpins, you know, international drug cartels, we can put those people in prison for sure. But I think for someone who just has a drug habit that doesn't have a prior violent felony and isn't dealing a huge amount of drugs, I think we need to look at these other approaches because the records, the evidence shows they're a lot more cost effective.
One more call. Our time is short. But Frederick in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks, Frederick. You're on.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Clearly, there's a great deal of passionate debate about the remarkable increase in the U.S. incarceration rate,
yeah,
especially compared with other nations, as you've noted. Two quick points. First, the rapid increase in incarceration rates that began in the 1970s happened to be correlated with widespread deinstitutionalization of public psychiatric hospitals, and national data clearly indicate that about 18% of today's prison inmates have been diagnosed with severe persistent mental illness, schizophrenia,
okay,
bipolar disorder.
Yeah, that's big.
And I have worked in the prison system for over two decades. These are frequent flyer inmates whose needs have to be addressed. They often lack access to high-quality community-based treatment once they are released from prison, and we have the revolving prison gate.
So we're kind of using prisons to deal with our mental health issues. Very quick, Frederick.
The second point, national data also indicate that approximately 85% of inmates serving time in the United States of America are serving time for offenses that are drug or alcohol related, driving under the influence with death resulting, selling heroin,
yeah,
cocaine,
yeah,
85%. Far-sighted reform, in my view, has to address the needs of inmates with significant mental illness and addiction issues during and following incarceration. Otherwise,
Frederick, we're out of time right there, but we've got your point. Brian, do you think it's going to happen? Is this issue up on the rails in this country and pushed by fiscal crisis in a way that's going to bring a real change, Brian?
I think as long as the budget pressure is there and as long as the crime rates remain low, this reform movement is going to continue. The pressure is going to build.
It would sure be great to find a better way on all kinds of fronts here. I'm very grateful for all the insights in this hour from everyone who's here. Mark Levin in Austin, Texas at Right on Crime. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Maurer with the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And Brian Mann with the Prison Time Media Project at North Country Public Radio. Great work, Brian. Keep it up. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.